and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, believe it or not, set up in 2002, goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, local chap Kevin McGimpsey talks about his communications with his MP. We start, as usual, with a chat with Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
This week, you've got a bit of a special guest on the line, I understand, Gadal Ebert. Tell us a bit about him before we speak to him.
Yes, he was introduced to me as the biggest bankruptcy case known to a group that's specialised in financial exploitation. And when I was at their meeting, I said, we need a group against legal exploitation as well. And so at that point, I gathered four cases, and Mr. Ebert's was the first one, that I presented to Kenneth Clark and Vince Cable, because we wanted to alert them to the fact that these bankruptcies are fraudulent, are not based on the rule of law. And we ended up publishing the first two of those four cases. Mr. Ebert's was the volume one in the forensics of legal fraud, and the other one was volume two, and that lady isn't alive anymore. And that shows how long these fights are that victims have to take upon themselves.
Now, you talk about the forensics of legal fraud, and that sounds to me as if it may be lawyers actually in cahoots with criminals.
Absolutely well spotted, Tony. That's exactly right. In Mr. Ebert's case, it's not just lawyers, it's accountants and bankers, and that's what I've discovered everywhere and anywhere as well, that I can only call them criminals. Well, white-collar criminals who are colluding with each other against the victim, and they certainly don't operate according to any rules or morals or ethics, let alone the law. And so in the process then, the victims are more than disturbed, more than victimized and traumatized, develop what some people call the legal abuse syndrome, become experts, each in their own way, in the law, but are not necessarily particularly able to kind of get to the gist of it, because it's all so complex and so complicated. And therefore, I welcome the quality of questions you always tend to ask. I mean, Mr. Ebert has been in prison as part of the cover-up of his bankruptcy.
Okay.
He just said he wasn't imprisoned.
Let's have a chat
with
him.
He was kidnapped. No.
Okay, let's hear from him now anyway, directly.
Okay, I'll pass you on to him. You ask, he is happy to answer any of your questions, okay?
A very good evening.
Hello, Mr. Ebert. Can you just tell us how you got into this pickle? Because Sabine has just been describing your case, your situation, as being a kind of legal fraud. So just tell us about how that bankruptcy happened, what your business was like, and how you came a cropper.
Well, let's put it this way. I am not bankrupt in law. There is a false document, yeah? Apparently a bankruptcy order, but it's not even registered. This came to light now. How it came about, I had a company, a very big company, a developing company with a partner in Liverpool, and somehow my partner had difficulties with the bank, and the bank wanted to kick me out of it.
Well, just let me hold you there, because what kind of company was it? What sort of business
properties.
Were you operating?
Properties.
Okay, and what sort of property? Was it property development? Was it business property?
No, it was
domestic?
Mostly residential.
Okay, and what happened then?
And then somehow my partner had difficulties with the bank, with one of the banks, and the bank started to put all kind of tricks, and they transferred apparently the company to a foreign company, and there was dispute about this, and I said I'm not giving up, and they wanted to get rid of me. But end of the day, they tried to bankruptcy. They didn't succeed 5 times. And then they colluded, I believe, with Midland Bank, at the time Midland Bank, then HSBC. And HSBC just made a fiction date. There is no debt, there is nothing.
Okay, so... Yeah, you carry on.
The petition is a false document. There is no such a debt. Nothing exists. It's all made up. And they presented it. The judge was notified that there is no debt, but he didn't care. And he, behind the closed door, I think the bankrupt. They issued a bankruptcy order, but it's not recorded at all.
Now, isn't there a bit of a problem here? Because you're working with a partner. You don't necessarily know the kind of deals that your partner has entered into without necessarily running it past you, Mr. Ebert.
No, there's nothing to do. HSBC has nothing to do with my partner. HSBC is a completely entity for itself, which the company had apparently overdraft, and my partner were guarantors, and there was no overdraft. There was an overdraft, but at the time that they wanted to liquidate the company, there was, or claiming that there is a debt, there was over £500,000 credit on the account. Shortcut, they never produced any accounts. They claim the accounts disappeared. If this is good for you.
Yeah. Now, HSBC, of course, are in the news this week. They're handing a £2 million pound bonus to one of their bosses, yes. Even though HSBC has been given one of the biggest fines ever for doing money laundering of Mexican drug cartels' money. Now, I mean, it seems to me that maybe, you know, that these banks aren't necessarily 100% trustworthy. I mean, the thing is that we do entirely, you know, if we've got an account with one of these banks, we do entirely trust them, don't we? So, anyway, how are you getting on now with your attempts to get justice with a bit of help from Sabine?
Well, I'm getting justice. I will get justice. But it's a fight, because my plus is that everything from the financial institution are the corrupt. The only thing what they have got is money. And through the money, they are buying of solicitors, judges, and everything what you dream. And I've got all the evidence to it.
Okay, you've got evidence that judges have been paid off?
I haven't got the check and the money in the hand that they paid, but it's unreasonable to make such decisions contrary to the law, yeah?
Okay, so you're saying that there may have been some sort of collusion, but not necessarily...
No, this I can say guarantee.
Okay.
If there was collusion, there's no question about that.
Well, the thing is, a judge is supposed to not to collude with one party or the other, so what evidence do you have for collusion?
Yes, I'll tell you which evidence I've got. Sabine has got it on her website. 18 posters, wanted posters. You know what wanted poster is?
Well, I mean, that sounds like something from the Wild West.
It's for the Wild West, it won't happen what happened here. It's much worse. It's worse than in the Nazi, the Gestapo, or by Zimbabwe. Yeah? People cannot believe the truth, and I've got the evidence. This is their problem.
Okay, Mr. Ebert, if people want to follow up your case, where can we find you online? What kind of documents? Because Sabine was telling me that there's actually been a book published about your case.
Yes, but this is already... Yes, there is a book where you can see on Sabine's website, and you can see what she made a website on my name, and you can have my details and address, and you can contact me anytime, and you can see it, and if you take time to see the documents, you will be surprised how I present it. I tell you more than that. They got fed up, so they wanted to put me in mental house now. So they ordered 2 psychiatric reports to get a mental assessment on me, yes?
Well, that sounds pretty frightening, but can you just finish...
It's not frightening. It's frightening for any other citizen, not for me.
Oh, right.
It's a plus, because now one of the psychiatric refused to make his report on legal advice, and the other one was courage to write it, so he wrote 11 pages, which this is my CV. I'm using it as my CV. He writes exactly my case and my position, and it's far away from any mentally problem. It's a problem with the judiciary. It's in a report. I got it.
Okay.
It's today published.
So, for people that want to actually follow this, can you just... I know it might sound very boring, but could you spell your name out so people can
my
look for you on
the internet? My name is...
Can you spell out your first name as well? Because
yes.
It's a little bit complicated to spell.
G-E-D-A-L-J-A-H-U. That's my first name. Gedaliahu.
Okay, and the second name, Ebert.
E-B-E-R-T.
E-B-E-R-T. Well, thanks ever so much for chatting to us, and we'll put a link on the program page to your information, particularly about your book. Now, could you hand us back over to Sabine, please?
Yes, I will give you Sabine.
Thank you.
Welcome into the world of victims of white-collar crimes, Tony.
Oh, crikey.
Yes.
Sounds like that's a case that's been going on quite a while. What are your thoughts, Sabine, about the chances of him getting justice?
I have a feeling that currently we are seeing a bit of breakthrough times, and he has actually achieved in a judicial review a tiny step, which is that two judges have said that one particular judgment was unlawful, but he came here tonight to explain to me why that is not what he needs and wants, and I've taken a bit of a back step from his case. So if whether and when he will get justice, my feeling is that that it's like with the Musa case. We can only win it on the back of a whole bunch of cases, not on each in their own merit. I have this week presented a 4-to-5-page letter to the Attorney General about the whole child snatching cases. And I just feel in individual cases are so stitched up, and they are, the system, the establishment is so able to cover things up and collude with the right players at the right time, that is very hard. But I'm quite genuinely hoping for a general kind of amnesty or jubilee as the face-saving operation that is necessary for the country now, Tony.
Well, Gedal Ebert doesn't sound to me like the sort of person that's going to give up easily.
No. That's exactly why. I mean, I mainly work with victims turned starfighters who don't give up. That's exactly right. I mean, he has been at it for at least 17 years, and if I keep the count correctly. And
17 years, incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got a guest in the studio here. It's Kevin McGimpsey. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello there.
Now, you've been having a little listen in there. Can you just relate to us your communications with your MP? Because when people get problems with the judiciary or anything, really, one of the first people that they think to write to is their MP. I mean, you know, many people are writing at the moment about, for example, Iran, but they're worried about an attack on Iran or helping terrorists in Syria, this kind of thing, about foreign policy. Sometimes it's about very local issues. But what have your experience been with communicating with your local MP, and who is he, first of all?
Right. Well, my local MP is Mr. Stephen Williams, who is a Liberal Democrat for Bristol West.
Now, he's also in the Liberal Democrats' Treasury. The coalition treasury team of some sort, isn't he? He's not a minister, but I think isn't he part of that?
Well, he would probably like to be a minister.
Okay. Anyway, so what have you been writing to him about, and how did you get on?
Right. Well, I've been writing to him about two main topics. One is his own constituents who are suffering as regards the cuts. I was speaking to one person in particular who has she was on incapacity allowance. She can hardly move her body, and she suffers from chronic asthma and all the rest of it, and she was struck off by ATOS.
These are these people from France who've been brought in,
yes,
in an attempt, really, they're being paid, aren't they, to get people
That's
off
right.
of the benefit system.
That's right. And I wrote to Stephen Williams now, let's see, that would be, it's coming up for 4 months now, when I initially raised this particular case. I also raised the case of another constituent who is she's disabled as well. I'm not sure if she's on benefit or not, but she's hobbling around on a crutch anyway, and she's suffered from she fell quite a long distance, and she's got multiple injuries, and she's looking for follow-up operations at the BRI.
So, I mean, the first point of call for these people surely is the benefits, or in the first case, you know, the Department for Work and Pensions, the Job Centre, wherever.
Mm.
And for the second case, the first point of call should be the NHS, surely.
Yeah,
why have you decided to go to the MP?
Well, I wanted to get a response out of him. What I did, actually, I wrote to him. I said, what I would like from you is for you to tell me if you're telling your constituents as part of the coalition, if you're telling them that we're all in this together, which is the catch line of the neoliberal economic policy, then I would like to know what hardships are you going through that would compare with the hardships of your constituents whom I've raised. Now I have received no reply whatsoever to this question.
Okay, that's after 4 months. Now, I mean, it is a bit of an awkward question to ask, isn't it?
Well,
because
it is,
I mean, this is something which is basically a Conservative strapline. You're writing to a Liberal Democrat MP asking him to defend what is a slogan, a political slogan from another party. I mean, maybe that's why he's not written back.
Well, it may be another party, but he's in coalition with them, and he's also written back to me to say that he thinks that paying off the deficit, as he puts it, is the most important pressing issue, and if that means making cuts right, left and centre, then he's perfectly willing to do so.
Okay, well, Sabine, thanks for hanging on. Can you just give us your take maybe on this particular case, and then have explain to us really a bit more generally about, you know, successful or otherwise communications with MPs?
Yes, this is such a perfect hook. It shows that and how MPs are misled to believe anything and everything about the national debt, which was for me the big trigger on how to analyze the money system and how I got into subsequently helping the victims. It's really, really sad, and I can completely understand Kevin's question, and I'm not surprised by the answer of his MP, because they are ultimately, in my experience, best only to be used for writing letters on behalf of constituents to ministers. There was one MP ages ago who said that that being an MP is nothing about being statesmanship anymore. It's just being a constituency MP. And that's what I've experienced with my MP, Glenda Jackson. She writes beautifully, efficient letters on my behalf, but she's useless on the bigger picture, whether it's money, whether it's child snatching, whether it's white-collar crime. And that tends to be my experience with most MPs. I have analyzed how they sign early day motions as a way of getting a profile for them. And I have a few whom I consider gold dust, and I have a few who do not mind going outside their constituency and going after issues that are a bit more than just a local issue of one or two constituents. But Kevin has really put his finger on the point. These austerity cuts are not necessary. And he has done a beautiful job explaining how it boils down to and how it does affect people locally. And it's just the most tremendous and horrendous way in which the state operates. It's just so tragic. And I guess in a way I saw it coming, but...
No, it's not in a way, Sabine. I mean, you've been talking about these sorts of economic problems brewing up for a long time.
Yes.
It's certainly not fair to say that nobody predicted it, because you were one of the people 10 years ago that
was
predicting this kind of thing. Finally, a bit of advice for Kevin and for others that are thinking of writing to their MPs about the cuts and about the economy. Is there anything that you think that people should really be focusing on, maybe to do with what's wrong with what they're doing at the moment and what the better solutions might be?
Well, I can easily refer Kevin to a few of my websites and a few of my key points. I mean, in 2008, we submitted our submission to the Treasury Select Committee that and how the government can create its own money and spend it into the economy. At the time, I called it green credit for green purposes, because the Treasury Select Committee looked into climate change. But the principle remains the same. And now... Lord Turner of the Financial Services Authority called it overt monetary financing, OMF. But that's exactly it. And and he thought it was a completely daring concept. But Austin Mitchell has been calling it public credit ever since 2002, when we started tabling these early day motions.
Yeah, because at the moment what seems to be happening is that the Bank of England is making money available and quantitative easing to the banks, but that money is then just disappearing into a big black hole and not finding its way to the rest of us.
That's exactly right, and that's the big black hole of big black banks and the people who run them, but never into the real economy. That's this big financial economy as a big bubble that completely exploits the real economy. This quantitative easing is not proper money creation. It's just credit creation, which adds to the way of exploiting the economy. That's the eternal mechanism. And for MPs to believe that this national deficit needs to be paid off is just one of the biggest myths that has been introduced, and it just annoys me.
Okay, well, Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite, thanks very much for joining us again. Now, back to our guest is Kevin McGimpsey. Kevin, your
Hello
situation
there.
Is really, you know, you're one of these people that writes away to your MP and you expect a reply. Now, give us an idea of how long you might expect to wait for a reply from your MP.
Well, as far as Mr. Williams is concerned, for his last letter I waited 3 months, and in addition I had to phone his Westminster constituency office twice in order to elicit that response.
And
in fact,
was it because it was a bit of a complicated letter to answer, possibly?
It was certainly complicated. But he had compounded that because new issues came up while I was waiting for the first one. So if he'd responded to the first one on time, then it wouldn't have been half as complicated.
Now, what about other people who've been in that constituency? It was Valerie Davey, was a Labour Party MP that constituency, in your constituency, before Stephen Williams. So how does he compare with her as responding to letters?
Well, I have to say Mr. Williams's levels of response have been the worst so far. The first one I wrote to in the constituency was William Waldegrave, who was a Tory.
Now, he's also a big landowner, isn't he? He's one of the biggest landowners in Somerset. Lives down towards Wells, a big estate down there. Yes, and so he's a sort of old-style feudal Tory, in a way.
Yeah.
And maybe he had a bit more resources. But how long did it take him to get back to you?
Well, I wrote to him a couple of times, and he got back to me... Within a month. It was a typical Tory response, but I got it, and it was drafted by him.
Okay, so He was a minister, I believe, wasn't he? Wasn't he even a cabinet minister, I think, William Waldegrave, at some point?
I believe so, yes.
So you would expect maybe he was going to have lots of other business as well as just talking to his constituents. But anyway, so how did William Waldegrave compare to Valerie Davey and Stephen Williams? Because that's, I mean, actually, you've got all three parties,
well,
haven't you? You've got the Conservatives, you've got Labour, indeed. And then you've got Lib Dems, the three main parties.
Yeah. Well, the Labour woman, Valerie Davey, I wrote to mainly in connection with the Iraq War, and because she abstained in that, and that was her downfall, I believe. And she would take roughly between 1 and 2 months to get back to me, and her level of response, even though it was politically unsatisfactory, she had actually gone to the bother of crafting me a proper letter. So on that account, she does better than Mr. Williams.
Now, I know you got so niffed with Mr. Williams not replying quickly enough that you decided you were going to actually write to his party chairman. Who's that and how did you get on?
Well, Andrew Morgan is his name, and I wrote to him, and I said to him what my side of the story as far as Mr. Williams was concerned, and I wrote to him a very reasonable letter. I got a cheerful reply. He was going to investigate it, and he was a little bit worried, obviously, but he wasn't hostile, and then the next thing I knew was within a few days I got a letter which just expressed total fury that I dared to question Mr. Williams. He said he'd looked into the case. He found Mr. Williams to be completely exonerated. And he said to me as well, he said to me something quite interesting. He said, you're in a constituency of 90,000 constituents. And out of that, you are the only one to have ever complained about Mr. Stephen Williams.
So did you get any response so far about those specific constituents, the two people you were talking about, the one who was having problems with claiming benefits and the other one who was having problems with
getting the operations? No.
Okay, well, and how long ago was that?
Well, I wrote to him on the 18th of October last year, originally, about it.
Okay, and still no response.
I still
what about
no response.
The surgery? Because you can actually go and see Stephen Williams and other MPs, can't you, face to face?
Well, yes, I've done that too. I went as part of a 38 degrees group of people who went along to. We were campaigning on the issue of preventing privatisation of the NHS. We went along. Now this is quite early on in the history of the coalition. It wasn't a recent thing, and we went along to get him to say that he was going to oppose any privatisation of the NHS. He not only refused to do so, but he was also very defensive and very aggressive in his dealings with us. When we came out, there's five people came out, all constituents of Mr. Williams. We came out. And the consensus was, it wasn't initiated from me, I didn't say anything, but two other people said that they had found Mr. Williams's behaviour disgusting.
Well, what would you say are his chances of getting back in at the next general election in a couple of years' time?
Well, I don't know. It all depends how people I would suggest his vote's already falling. I would suggest he's probably on his way out, but people have to be aware of what sort of person they're being represented by.
No, I mean, one of the things, spin-offs from what you're saying today, is people listening may think, well, I mean, you know, maybe there's no point in writing to your MP. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say you still need to be writing to them because that's the only way that they know you exist.
Okay, well, that's Kevin McGimpsey. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Over to Enrique Ribeiro now. This is resumed from part one last week when we was chatting to him about, because his father and his uncle were two of the revolutionaries in 1974, April the 25th, in the Portuguese Revolution, and his granddad was in the secret police. So unbeknownst to his granddad, he had two revolutionaries and the revolutionary's son. So let's have a listen now to the second half of that. And Enrique Ribeiro is now living here in Bristol. So that's why we're having a chat with him. But it's certainly a fascinating revolution. It was the only revolution, certainly, that I've come across, which was a coup by the military, by the army, against a fascist dictatorship. And the army took over in order to make sure there were democratic elections. So let's listen now to the continuation of my interview, and starting really with this musical song, La Via Morena. And this was the song which was playing on the radio in Portugal to signal to the population and to the army that the coup was about to start. Now, the song, tell us a bit about the song that was played on the radio, because it had a bit of a code in it as well,
yeah.
And it was, the idea was a signal, it was played on the April the 25th, 1974.
Yeah.
What day of the week was it?
I don't know.
That was, actually, I was putting you on the spot there.
I don't know, actually.
We'll I'll just check that out before the end of the programme.
Yes.
But just tell us about that song and the significance of it.
The song is a song that says that... A Grande Vila Morena, you are a tanned village, and you are the land of the fraternity. So here is already disguised there in the way of saying that the fraternity, you know, you are the land of fraternity, and the people, o povo, the pleb, the people is people, povo, land, and the people is who leads that inside of you, O city. So this is a song that the government, when was to see this is gonna pass or not, you know, we're gonna censor this or not, he says Grândola is a really small village. Okay, Vila Morena, oh, it's loads of sun there, it's hot. Okay, Terra of Fraternity. Okay. Oh, the people is really the who leads there on the inside of you or city. Okay. It's just on their city. I don't want to know. But when they start and say, in each corner there is a friend, and on each face there is equality. Yeah. This is for everyone. Yeah. And when they say, yeah, that in each face of repeating there is equality, but then they say it is the people who lead, yeah, is for everyone. That's the song that leads everyone to the street on that morning.
But so how did that get past the censors, or
because
was it?
They had the radio.
Okay.
And
once they get into the radio, there's no chance to censor it.
No, because this song passed the censor before. They were already playing this song, yeah? But they knew that on the day that they had the radio and they said that put this song and say to the people to come back to the street, the people would go, because it's everything there. It's the soul.
Okay. It was a Thursday, by the way.
It was a Thursday.
Thursday is a good day
Beautiful
for a revolution.
Thursday.
For a revolution.
Beautiful.
And we've now got the sound of marching boots in the background, and we'll hear the song La Vila Morena. Now, do you want to pronounce it properly?
Vila Morena. Vila Morena.
Grândola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, dentro de ti a cidade.
dentro de ti, ó cidade. O povo é quem mais ordena, terra da fraternidade, grande da Vila Morena.
Em cada esquina um amigo, em cada rosto igualdade, grândola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, terra da fraternidade,
grândola Vila Morena.
À sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade, jurei ter por companheira grândola a tua vontade, grândola a tua vontade,
jurei ter por companheira à sombra de uma azinheira
que já não sabia idade.
Yes, a lovely song.
Zeca Fons.
With a little bit of a accompaniment at the end there with Enrique Ribeiro. And Enrique, also, can you just tell us now about the sort of aftermath of the revolution and how you managed to, in Portugal, keep it? Because this is one of the things that obviously is... In any kind of upheaval like that, there's always a fear that there'll be a kind of counter-revolution. The people that used to run things will get back in control.
Well, yes, it was like this. We had the Communist Party for 6 months provisory to organize the country and do an election. For the first time, the women are voting, and my grandmother was voting for the first time. And they elect a prime minister and they kill him. My grandmother said this is the first time and the last time she never voted again.
So, sorry, who killed the prime minister?
The fascist party, the new fascist party. At least it was at his orders. I know who was. It was José Esteves. His name is José Esteves. Everyone knows he went on the television and everything. But he was the one that constructed the bomb on the plane, the Sacadura Cabral. But apart from that, the country changed. The same politicals appeared with new parties. So is the center party, so is the social party, the communist party. And we've been bouncing about. It's the same people. President that have been trafficking diamonds of blood from Africa. And all of that things, yeah. I sometimes have a little bit of anger. I don't want, because my father have done a revolution, and these friends have done a revolution without blood. And I think this time, if I go upset, maybe the arrows don't gonna be flowers anymore.
Because what you're saying is that the people that were replaced actually were criminals, and in some way they needed to be punished, or maybe even you're suggesting possibly even executed.
For example, what kind of conversation is this that a person that gets upset with an election in Lisbon, and I said to him on that night he needs to leave the country, the organization United Community put him as president of United Community. How is possible? So I stop an election, yeah, because I said the votes are counted, and we put it out the one we wanted as a council council of Lisbon, and the prime minister says, I can't be a prime minister of a country like this, and he goes away, and on the next week he is the president of the United Community, European Community. What kind of conversation is that? How we can explain everything?
So I suppose this is one other thing about your revolution is you're now in a situation of a very difficult financial situation. The freedom is running away.
Yes, the freedom is running away, and the people abandon their farms to go to the capitalist society, and now they don't have food because they don't produce their own food. The factories are closed because the foundations are communal, and where is the food? Without food, they start to get upset. And that's the problem. If you don't feed the masses, what happened with Louis XIV of France? If it doesn't feed the masses will go against you because the belly hurts.
Well, we're being told nowadays, aren't they, that there's not enough food in the world to go around.
But there is enough land and food and waste to give food to everyone. That's what I don't understand.
Okay, so there's no end in sight at the moment, anyway, to the crisis in Europe with people in Greece and Spain, Southern Europe and Portugal having a difficult time every... I don't think you need to be a genius to work out that it's getting worse and worse. It's not getting better. It's not going to get better in the foreseeable future. Financially, there's a debt. It has to be paid, supposedly, and the money is instead of going into the pockets of the people, is going off to the debt.
Yeah, this is like this. I'm really Masonic, actually. Nowadays, I feel like a Masonic anarch. Yeah, and I'm gonna tell one thing. I create an idea of death. Yeah, me myself, Enrique Anton Ribeiro. I create an idea of death, and all of you own money to me, and all of you need to pay me.
This
and
is
I
debt.
Resolve
debt.
The problem, debt. And yeah. I resolve the problem. So I give you a debt that I buy from you, and then you give me money. That's what it is. Masons again, free all of them, and bless them for their existence. Because like that, we have loads of shows, loads of festivals, loads of rage. But there is also suffering, and we all could live in peace. We all could live in peace. I had an idea, yeah, utopic idea that is like this. If we all balance the money, the capital, with debts, and we just produce for each other, all the countries, globally, we forgot the money, we just produce. We keep the money, keep everything you want, invent whatever you want, but just produce, keep the cycling working, and don't bother with anything else. Don't be more greedy. Don't want worries from Caesar, because one day Caesar come back, and Caesar is bad.
Okay, well, that's really been fascinating talking to you. That was Enrique Ribeiro, and quite a sensation, really, in a way. So you're a regular visitor in Bristol, are you?
Yes, I am. It's my second neighbourhood.
Okay, so hopefully we'll have you again sometime, because it's been a really fascinating history lesson for me. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, that's part two. Last week we had part one of Enrique's interview. And funnily enough, I've been contacted by a couple of people who were actually involved in one way or another in the Portuguese Revolution. So we're looking to do a follow-up programme. If you know anyone who was, we're actually looking at dedicating a couple of hours to having a real good drill into the 1974 Portuguese Revolution. Being particularly fascinating because it was the army taking over from a Masonic fascist government. I'm just trying to remember the guy's name. It's not Solares, something like that. Salazar something like that, from in Portugal. Anyway, now back to this week, and I'm joined by Jason Yannikopoulos. Hi, Jason, and welcome
Hello.
To Dialect. This week we're having another little look at Jack Lopresti, the Conservative MP who's featured in Private Eye, and you got a few more details for us, I understand, this
well,
week.
Well, it's more of a general look at the UK-Saudi arms deal, I mean, particularly the one that he's on.
Because he's been outed, really, by his well, I mean, I say outed, but he's a Freemason, one of Bristol's Freemasons, and he declared it as one of his interests when you had to a few years ago when he was a city councillor. But he's written down in the Declaration of Interests at the House of Commons that he's taken £6,600 from the Saudi government from a trip over to Saudi Arabia back in December. And Private Eye have been looking a little bit more into detail as at what that trip might have been about.
Well, yeah, it's on behalf, again, of GPT Special Project Man Limited. They're a subsidiary of the European defence giant, EADS.
OK, this is the company, just to refresh our memories, that were there last year, 2012, there was a discussion about them actually merging with BAE Systems to make probably
That's
one of the
right,
biggest,
yeah.
Private defence arms companies on the planet.
Well, yeah, I mean, if that happened, that means that BAE will be directly benefiting from billions, millions and billions of Saudi money.
Now, and the problem with Saudi, of course, is it's one of the highest scoring bad human rights record countries on Amnesty International's list, doing things like public beheadings and some pretty draconian stuff going on there, including torture, of course. So this is why there are always questions about whether Mr. Lopresti or anybody else should be over there. And is there actually any evidence that arms deals were being done? What do Private Eye say, Jason?
Well, they pointed out that this has been going back to 1962, when Jamal Nasser, who was the Soviet-backed president of Egypt, formed a Republican coup against the royalist regime in Yemen, leading British right-wingers to act because they perceived a threat to to Aden, which was at that point a British protectorate.
Oh, Aden, yes, I remember. Yeah, it was one of these little British companies that was left over after the Empire, really. But what's that got to do with Saudi?
Well, because they're both quite close to Saudi Arabia. So what happened at the time?
Well, it borders on it, doesn't it? In fact, yes. Yemen is down the bottom, basically. It borders on the south end of Saudi Arabia. In fact, Saudi Arabia is a gigantic peninsula, and Yemen is
massive,
sat on the end of it. And this is, known as one of the, if not the, richest oil-producing parts of the planet.
Well, what happened at the time was that Britain, we formed a thing called the British Field Liaison Force, and it was then that we agreed, initially to protect Aden, but also we agreed with Saudi Arabia a mutually beneficial military contract, as it were, to keep NASA's forces out of Saudi Arabia and indeed out of Aden. So.
Okay, so this is the sort of tradition that Jack has picked up on. What about, let's move on and just talk about Italy, because we've had a general election in Italy since we last spoke, and the comedian, Grillo, his name. Grillo. But what are your thoughts about what's been going on over there? Berlusconi now the leader of the opposition.
Oh, gosh. You know, I kind of wish that Berlusconi... Well, A, it never happened, you know. He really was on the... I mean, Mussolini aside, of course. He really was one of the worst leaders of Italy. I mean, this is a man who insulted quite a few foreign leaders. What was it? He went on record as saying some amazing things during his time, such as, you know, it's better to love beautiful women than it is to be gay.
Well, I know, and he's also, yes, like you say, he said, what did he say about Angela Merkel?
I'm not sure that's broadcastable on public radio.
Okay, give us a version of it that is, then.
I think he might have referred to her as, God, how do I put this?
Was she a bit plump or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, rather plump and distinctly unattractive.
I think, okay, that's about the only thing you can broadcast to do with what he said. Pretty appalling way to behave.
Especially to a woman who's negotiating a package to try and save your country. I mean, this is a man who went to the EU Commission when they're having a discussion about a financial package to save Italy, and he fell asleep during the discussion.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I don't think we've quite got as bad as that here in Britain yet, but I guess we're heading the similar way. It's a sort of dumbing down process where almost imbeciles seem to be taking over entire countries. I mean, it doesn't sound too good. Do you think there's some sort of agenda here? Because I wonder whether the idea of people like Berlusconi running something is just where you think, well, almost anybody that came along, even if it's another Hitler, would be seen as better than this kind of joke president.
I don't know about that, actually. And to be fair, Berlusconi was prime minister of Italy. He wasn't president.
Okay, fair enough. You put me straight there. All right, Jason. Okay, well, thanks very much for that. And we'll have another chat to you next week.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Okay, time for Jeff Sparks and his What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 8th of March, the Mods will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 pm. Also on 8th of March, the DB Band, who feature Mick Quinn of Supergrass, will be performing at Moles in 14 George Street, Bath. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7 pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Procol Harum. This group formed in 1967 and split up in 1977, then reformed in 1991 and are still performing to this day. In their career, they have released 12 studio albums and 4 live albums. This is from their second album, Shine On Brightly, which was released in 1968, and it's the song, Shine On Brightly.
Russian blue electric clocks. The alarm bell rings, it will not stop. And I can see no end in sight. And search in vain by candlelight for some long road.
Shine On Brightly from their second album, Shine On Brightly. For more information, you can check out ProcolHarum.com. Moving into Saturday 9th of March, Ruts DC will be performing with support from Criminal Mind at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £14 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 10th of March, Breed 77 will be performing with support from Left Unscarred for the Imperium, Seven Deadly and Broken Jaw at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
And thanks to you, Jeffrey. That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. And if you're listening online, I, Tony Gosling, will bring you the BCFM Politics Show Friday Drive Time every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. In fact, if you're listening online or on FM here in Bristol. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Kevin McGimpsey and Gadel Ebert, and also Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us please through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Find them on the web too at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.